listening to Funding Rural. I'm Erin Borlow with the Roundhouse Foundation. I'm also a fellow with the National Center for Family Philanthropy. I want to take a minute and zoom out to get a 10,000-foot view of philanthropy in rural spaces, and I've got just the guy to join me on that journey. Alan Smart has been working in philanthropy for decades. He spent a lot of time in the South, Louisiana, and North Carolina, working with family foundations. But over the course of his career, he's established himself as a guide and a thought leader in philanthropy, specifically around rural issues, and has done consulting work with philanthropic organizations around the country. I got connected to Alan through a partner philanthropy-serving organization who said, "Hey, you're working in rural. You must know this guy, the one other guy I know working in rural." Alan grew up in rural Maine and has held on to those roots in his work by pushing funders to think about how to better support rural communities. He's written some great stuff about it, and we'll share links to those pieces as well as his work at Philanthropy Works, a transcript of this conversation, and more in our show notes at fundingrural.com.
I got really turned on to this idea that there was something significantly different about being effective in philanthropy when working in a rural place. And that if a funder did not acknowledge that or have people, staff, boards who could kind of lift that up and hold that with pride, that you were destined to be at best kind of transactional and additive at the fringes. But if you wanted to do something significant, you really had to recognize you were in a different place. And philanthropy could be many things to many people, but had to call upon kind of a set of principles that would lend itself to being effective. So I think the landscape has changed. I like to say there has always been a deep presence of family foundations in rural, and that continues to be the case, although certainly many of the family members who are associated with the rural work no longer live in the places where the wealth was generated. So it's very different than being, having people living in the same community and mm-hmm. providing what in many cases 50 or 75 years ago was a lot of, very strong kind of charitable work. Yeah. That's very associated with the family, and now often because the family members are not in the same place, has become more of a strategic effort that would mirror the larger philanthropic community in many ways. But certainly, as you might expect, there is less rural philanthropy in general going on in a Wyoming or Nevada or some places that I think we know, the popular sentiment would be, those places have fewer people, there's going to be fewer philanthropic assets. But, certainly there are places, and I'll use Louisiana as an example, which is, almost infamously, burdened by all sorts of resource issues and, poor morbidity, mortality, and on from there. They are going to have in the next 12 months the creation of a $3 billion plus mm-hmm. foundation from the sale of their statewide Blue Cross Blue Shield carrier to a similar organization, but not one that's locally based. So even in a Louisiana, there will be, at least on a proportional basis, a significant amount of philanthropic assets that didn't exist before.
Yeah.
Still, there are states where if I was asked, who are the rural philanthropic leaders, whether it be individuals or foundations, in X state. There's still 10 or 15 because of population or just the heritage of how philanthropy evolved there that are not part of our normal conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think 10 or 15 years ago, that 10 or 15 number may have been 20 or 25. So there's really, it's improving in ways I think that are really that can be tracked and are going to be significant in how we look at kind of the philanthropy over the decades.
Yeah. So how do you think place affects the funding priorities and decision making? I mean, you've had your finger on the pulse. So how do you think that impacts when you're not in a place?
Yeah, I want to put a positive spin on it in that I think there are a significant number of funders who are urban based who are doing great rural work. But also say it's harder, and they are committed to it. Mm-hmm. But the ability to have staff who are routinely in rural places, whether they be literally have a physical address, mm-hmm. or that's they're just tasked with being there all the time, that gets you 75% of the way there. And the other 25% is gets I think into the strategy and best practice and really what you want to do with those relationships. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you embed kind of just rural knowledge, rural thinking, rural ethos into the everyday of a foundation that's doing both urban and rural work? Mm-hmm. That you don't have to segregate it in a way that puts it almost in competition internally to the foundation, mm-hmm. about, it's a zero-sum game, and well, if the rural people get more, then, our urban friends are not going to get more, they're going to get less. And and when you get into, certainly at certain types of funders in certain geographies, that does become an internal staff discussion about, so we believed and said we are really going to focus on these African American urban communities, and now you're going to take money away from that and you're going to go find these rural white people because somehow they have had similar experiences or need to be attended to just as much. And I certainly know a number of funders where that is I think real staff tension. Mm-hmm. That people live every day, and it never resolves, unfortunately. But I think that's a leadership issue. But I think it is important that funders. I'm often, when I do consulting with funders, I'll say, it would be great if you had kind of a rural quality of control person identified internally, mm-hmm. where say half their job was to make sure that everything from the RFP to the review process to how the program staff are deployed puts rural communities in a fair position, mm-hmm. and counterpoint to larger, better resourced urban places. Yeah. My least favorite form of rural philanthropy, but often the one that funders default to because it's the easiest, is to identify a couple nonprofits or a couple people and essentially allow those people to define what work goes on in a rural county or a rural region because they know how to speak to the funder. And mm-hmm. the funder is comfortable with the idea they have someone who knows kind of how the traditional funder community relationship is supposed to go.
Yeah.
I have always been hesitant and in some cases really opposed to this idea that some people carry that, well, funders just need to put a lot more money into rural places because it's inequitable, the distribution now, and we go back to the data, all true. Mm-hmm. But the idea, my belief would be quick infusions of enormous philanthropic resources, say over a 5 or 10 year period into most places, will actually reinforce the status quo because funders will default to the folks who know how to talk to them.
Yeah, and it comes down to, we talk a lot about volunteer boards in our organization. Mm-hmm. And what happens when you get a significant investment in a community that is wearing, a person's wearing multiple hats, they're doing multiple things, mm-hmm. it blows the organization up from the inside out because the mm-hmm. reality of being on a board, if you look at the federal IRS regulations, is you're fiscally responsible mm-hmm. for that agency. So if you get a huge infusion of cash, and I'm not by any means advocating that rural communities don't need more money.
Of course.
They do need more money. We just need to do it thoughtfully. And a blank check or an open check can sometimes cause problems internally. And so it comes back to listening, to understanding, and really hearing what communities are saying, and recognizing as a funder that one, we might screw it up, and that's okay. If you know from the beginning, like, I'm going to try this and see mm-hmm. how it works. And if it doesn't work, I need to own that and try mm-hmm. again in a different way. I mean, we've all had screw ups, right? I think the other piece that's really interesting is sometimes it's not the check that's needed. Mm-hmm. I had, and I use this example in other things as well, but as we were growing and getting to know organizations, I had a meeting with a person that runs an organization in Northeast Oregon. And we met multiple times. And then our grant application opportunity came up and they didn't apply. And I reached out and I said, hey, we've been chatting a lot.
Oh, you were going to apply.
I like you. I love what you're doing. I'm anxious to see how we can support you financially. And she reached back out and she said, I didn't need your money. I needed the three connections that you gave me to right. these other organizations. I'm going to come back. And eventually, as I build this process, I'll come back to you for funding. But that was also this moment of like, oh my gosh, we just need, rural can be so far from where decisions are made about community that we get head down and focused on, I just got to, you know, in the food, I just got to get food out the door through the food bank. I just got to make sure people get access to basic needs. I just got to make sure my kids are well taken care of in my class. And it's day by day that we forget that other people have done this work in different places that may mirror what we're doing and have had experiences. So building that sort of network of interconnectivity, mm-hmm. I think is such a powerful move.
Well, I'll bring you back to one of the first things we talked about, which is, I think, the exact illustration of what you described, which is if funders are evaluating program staff and them delivering grants versus creating long-term effective relationships in rural, I don't think you can ever get anywhere. Mm. You know, you're potential grantee maybe 5 years from now just described all the value you just provided, mm-hmm. but in standard philanthropic measurement, you know, that person, you in this case, kind of doesn't get any credit for all mm-hmm. this relationship building.
Yeah.
When in fact a different type of evaluation model or some different, you know, tracking mechanisms would allow, you know, the folks you were talking to say, yeah, no, we, you know, this was really valuable to us in these three distinct ways.
Yeah. No, that's super interesting. I think, I don't know if I've ever thought of it that way, where we, as funders, are evaluating our team members on hard applications, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever thought of it that way. We're such a relational organization that I'm like, how many people did you talk to? Who else did you talk to? Who else is over there? What else are they doing?
Yeah, I think it's still the norm for most funders that program staff only have the latitude, you know, to a certain extent to work with people or to talk with people or to help people who are not going to be grantees.
Yeah.
You know, the emphasis is still so much on, you know, the locus of effort, mm-hmm. you know, is evidenced by grant making. And that's just not a good rural fit, because in the situation you describe, it sounds like an organization of some kind of wherewithal is able to use information to kind of help themselves move ahead without a grant. Mm-hmm. In other cases, there may be no reason to ever make a grant to certain kinds of organizations or communities or efforts, but there may be a lot of reason to make sure that they have, you know, that they can text the chief of staff to the congressman, you know, yeah. the special phone number. Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's the value you just created. And I think that we really miss kind of forest for the trees. We have not figured out that grant making is not it, nor is grant making to all sorts of statewide or national groups who then you say are going to do this rural work, or the work, essentially the work is going to trickle down to rural.
That
can certainly be effective, I think, primarily in kinds of policy advocacy stuff that needs to be done, you know, perhaps on a state or federal level. Mm-hmm. But the easy way out is often, we'll fund the one statewide group or the one national intermediary to do work that's going to hit local in rural. And it's, I think, reasonably rural people do not believe that's going to happen.
I think as we you've touched on so many great things, which I love so much. But as we come to a close here, I want to talk about one of the articles that you recently wrote, where you mention, and the title of it is "Think About Rural America as a Place and Not an Issue." Mm-hmm. But I want to hear your thoughts around this piece.
Yeah, I think I'm really bent on this idea that if funders are going to be effective in rural, they need to understand not just the people, but, for example, other funders. And who are most of the other funders? Most of the other funders are governmental. Mm-hmm. So if you in a vacuum are deciding you are going to, you know, invest, you know, in some rural county $500,000 in you know, early childcare, but don't have an understanding of, you know, all kind of the moving parts of who's paying for what and who's really left out, and you know, and the fact that that actually relates to, you know, the pediatricians just left town, all this, you know, this snowball kind of thing that that happens, and there used to be all this church-based childcare, but the pastor left at that church, so it's not happening there anymore, and now they're all these things. We don't actually understand the place and the history and how all these issues intersect. I think the chances of any of your philanthropic work being sustained past a three-year grant are slim to none.
Yeah.
The work that will sustain is that gets embedded in a way that kind of fits the capacity of the place.
Yeah.
And it's not a kind of an add-on where you funded three new positions, you know, for some school-based health clinic, and, you know, which no one will ever pay for again. But perhaps, you know, a melding of funds and, you know, halftime across different places, and some family getting involved, and, you know, the on the ground work of understanding what's possible versus, well, it's easy for us to write a grant, to issue a grant and say, look, you know, we're really investing in this community.
Yeah, I think you touch on the intersectionality of work, and you know, I've been a trustee on this organization for almost 10 years, and staff for just about 4, and it's interesting to see. Well, we don't fund that. We're an arts funder. We don't fund that. We're a climate funder.
Amazing. Amazing. And it still goes on.
It is remarkable to me. And it just doesn't exist in rural. I mean, I have a staff member who would say the magic happens at the intersection. And I love that because it really, truly is true. Like, we can't talk about education, like use your third grade literacy as an example, without talking about food security, without talking about transportation challenges, without talking about broadband access. I mean, they're all intersectional.
Yeah, I'm certainly sympathetic, and there are certain types of family foundations, certain type of legacy trusts and similar mechanisms where, you know, that issue stuff is embedded essentially in the legal aspects of the creation. But in having worked with some of those folks, you know, what I'm trying to get them to think about is, okay, we can't do grant making to, you know, on that issue, but you could certainly be relationally helping the people you are doing grant making connect with those people.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't cost you anything. That's not illegal. You know.
Relational capital, I think, is what someone said.
So everyone has an opportunity to do better in that kind of community building stuff that is not necessarily about a program or protocol, is about long-term commitment. And I, you know, hate to say it, but, you know, you got to love this stuff. It can't just be something on your strategic plan. And that's why I'm sure heard me talk about this. What's the best thing someone, funder could do to get better at rural? I said, well, think about hiring some rural people on your staff, and that's going to at least get you part of the way. Mm-hmm. That at least you'll have someone to check your thinking.
Are there other things that you want to share and ensure that as we go on this journey with mm-hmm. encouraging people to build rural strategies, to have funders recognize that there's governmental funding and there's other types of funding? What are the other mm-hmm. things that you want to make sure that people leave with?
Yeah, I think it seems obvious, but it's actually more difficult to do than it sounds. So I think you have to, kind of put it on the list. I think you have to have peers in this work. Mm. I think being a rural funder or even a urban funder who wants to do some rural work in most states can be a very lonely experience. And you need others who are in similar situations or maybe a year or two ahead of you, or maybe you're helping people who are a year or two behind you. That's how I got so excited about this, is that, I was able to recruit kind of group of 6 or 8 funders and, sometimes the CEO, sometimes the program person, who were either just a little ahead or at our stage or a little behind. But we were all excited, but needed each other mm-hmm. because, what might look like a mistake to your board, you at least would be able to get some consolation from 4 other funders and around the country said, yeah, we did that and it didn't work out either. And here's why, and here's how we're adapting.
Yeah. I think that's great advice. And that's something we talk to our staff about frequently, is holding yourself with some grace, holding community with some grace, but in the end, showing up and connecting and I love speaking the rural ethos, that rural mm-hmm. thinking, bringing that voice and the values to the table. So there's lower barrier for entry and better accessibility. And I'm hopeful that's something that we can explore in this podcast. I'm hopeful there's opportunities for folks to build out some strategy that's going to be impactful. And I just really appreciate you helping me start the conversation today, Alan. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. I've really appreciated getting to know you over the last 3 or 4 years. And I often point to you all as like, these people are thinking hard about it. And, that's half the battle.
I think the most important thing I want to underline is that he talked about rural funders needing one another. I think funders in general need one another. This landscape in philanthropy can be very, very lonely. It's a very difficult, I don't want to use the word difficult because it's not a difficult job. We have a very easy job. The people on the ground have the difficult work. But I think it can be lonely, and it can come down to really needing others in this same field to have conversations and bigger conversations that can help us guide the work that we do collectively. So finding those mentors, finding those colleagues that understand the world of philanthropy, maybe that want to shift the world of philanthropy in a way that you may as well. That's been a huge help for me, is to have colleagues that I can call and go, oh my gosh, I'm struggling or I'm stuck. Being able to have that funding resource. I've been very fortunate that the National Center for Family Philanthropy, along with Wynn Rosser at TLL Temple, have been able to put together the Rural Peer Network, the Funder Peer Network. And we've been able to come together and just have a space to talk about issues that we're seeing in rural spaces that funders are dealing with and how we can learn from one another. And that's how we can really, really start changing some of these things that are happening. I like that Alan really talked about a rural quality control person on staff, right? Somebody ensures that the rural voice is being heard, or that the language is being said in a way that makes it accessible for community that may be farther away from the urban center or the power center. And also, I think that's a way that we try to bring in our grant evaluation committee, where it's folks from all across the state that help us look at different applications and say, hey, the way that you asked this question, it didn't make sense. And that's why they answered it this way. Getting that feedback from the field has been really helpful to our process and frankly made the process more inclusive. I really like that Alan touched on thinking about evaluating our staff internally in the foundation world on a different way, rather than based on the metrics or the number of dollars they get out the door, but really based on the relationships that are built and the connections that are made. You know, as a supervisor of a grants team, it's one thing that we really encourage. We want people to get out on the road and we want people to talk to one another and really learn and connect different communities that maybe are doing those same projects. So how do we build those connections if we aren't focused on building relationships? Thanks again for tuning in to Funding Rural. Be sure to check out Alan Smart's site at Philanthropy Works. He has some really great information about all sorts of different papers that he's written. He writes very casually and in a way that is really easy to understand and implement some of the work. I think he's just a valued asset in this philanthropic community. As always, we'll have show notes, a transcript for our show, and links to other information at fundingrural.com.